Welcome back. Second half of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are now chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Going to continue to focus on the resource sector, a little bit less on maybe what the election fallout could be, as we covered a lot of that with Joe Mazumdar in the first half of the show. Now it's more into some of the companies, some of the individual sectors within the resource stocks that we can get Matt's opinion on how he sees this market playing out. So Matt, let's start off with the junior market. Look, we have heard at length, at nauseam, really, just how much these juniors have continued to struggle in the face of a breakout in the gold price and consistent all-time highs in gold and even silver breaking out. We were seeing a lot of the juniors do a lot better in early October. I noticed a lot of juniors moving without even issuing any news releases. It was an interesting environment, but back half of October and even early November, those juniors started to fall back. Now, the debate being when the juniors run, that could be late cycle behavior, but they could also just be so undervalued that there could be a very impressive catch-up trade available. Matt, what's your takeaway from the junior market right now? Again, it ran in early October, has faded since.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good to be joining you. And I think, Corey, I think you characterized that very well. I mean, what we've seen this year, especially amongst the precious metal-focused juniors, is a lot of frustration. Gold price, silver price has done phenomenally year to date. And so this move was led by the metal prices. We started to see some of the major miners see some positive price action starting in the spring, and that's largely continued after a little breather over the summer. But I should note, we're still not seeing the leverage that one would expect to see by the major miners. They're maybe keeping track with the price of gold. Some of the better performing ones are doing better, but as a group, we're not seeing that 2 to 3x leverage that one would expect. But they are moving, and they have been for 6 months. But the juniors have been left in the dust for the vast majority of the year. I will say this did start to change, I think, quite acutely. I would say around the third week of September. If you look at the chart of the TSXV, you could maybe say, you know, second week of September. We started to see it in the MJG portfolio, at least in the latter half of September. And then this really kicked into high gear for the first 3 weeks of October. In fact, if we talked in the third week of October, I would have told you that we were on pace for potentially our very best month of performance going all the way back to December of 2020. We were up 34% in December 2020. I'm not saying we were up that, you know, in the third week of October. We were certainly up double digits on the month within the MJG portfolio. But to be frank, and you noted this, the past 10 to 11 trading days have been nothing short of brutal, you know, with pretty sharp pullbacks across a number of our larger and higher conviction positions within the MJG portfolio. This really started the day of the Newmont earnings miss. That was Thursday, October 24th, if I'm remembering correctly. So just two weeks ago. And then yesterday, the first trading day after Trump's reelection as U.S. president, was really insult to injury, with commodity prices and resource equities really the only risk on asset class that seemed to react poorly to Trump's reelection. Now, again, that is a one-day knee-jerk reaction. But, you know, the question becomes, have we seen a change in trend? Which, again, we had a really strong six-week period there for the juniors. Has this changed, or are we simply taking a breather? And as it stands, and I'm willing to change my mind, but for now, I'm in the breather camp. The bellwether metals, gold and copper, pricing continues to remain strong. Copper, notably, this is Thursday, November 7th when we're speaking, is up 4%, over 4% on the day, bringing it back into that very healthy, you know, 440, 450 per pound range. And then looking at the TSXV, and I don't want to put too much significance on technical analysis, because that's not the way that I drive investment decisions for the MJG partnership. But we remain well north of the, you know, psychologically significant 600 level on the TSXV. And also well above the moving averages, you know, 200-day moving averages around 580 on the TSXV that really signaled that this breakout was occurring. So for now, I remain optimistic, you know, quite optimistic, actually, that we're in the early stages of a strong move across the resource juniors. And as noted, there's a lot of catch up to be played because it's been, you know, it was really 9 months of neglect when a lot of the metal complex, particularly precious metal focused equities, the larger names, were performing quite well.
Well, Matt, just kind of building on that answer you just gave, you know, when you think about prior cycles, especially the 1970s or the 2001 through 2011 cycle, the mining stocks had really over a decade to kind of stretch their legs. And it sometimes wasn't until the very end of the move, the last year or two, that we really saw that huge outperformance. Is it possible that things are playing out in a more structured way for a longer term gain here in the precious metal sector and even in the critical mineral stocks? Because I think people are kind of shocked from what we saw in 2020, the pandemic crash and V-shaped response, and same thing with that 2016 short-lived response. Is this maybe a healthier bull market, I guess, is what I'm asking, because the majors are starting to move. We have seen the royalty companies move, and as the mid-tiers and the developers have started moving, maybe it's just going to take more time to filter down, like you're saying. Maybe it's just a breather, but could this extend out longer than the last two blips we've seen for just those very reasons?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's at least the glass half full perspective. I guess one could argue that the junior market is irreparably broken and we won't see significant performance regardless of metal prices and the performance of the larger producers. I do not think that is the case, but you know, we can remain open to that possibility. But I would argue this cycle is playing out more like it's supposed to, at least in a longer, more drawn out and powerful move. You mentioned 2016 and 2020. Super exciting periods, you know, particularly amongst the precious metal focused names. But those ended up largely being flashes in the pan. And we saw the gold price, the major producers, and the juniors really in both of those cases run in tandem. And it was exciting 6-9 month periods in both of those cases. But then there were hangovers in 2021 amongst the precious metal names and in 2017 as well. So I think the glass half full perspective is that this is a more healthy traditional move that could signal a longer and more powerful move. And I should also say, I mean, the gold price has come so much in the past 9 to 12 months. I mean, we're up 40% year to date, which is wild. Gold is not supposed to move that much in US dollar terms in a single year. So I think it'd be very healthy for the gold price to consolidate around its current levels for 3, 6, even 9 months. I wouldn't mind that at all. And, you know, if past is prologue, we could see some of this excitement around the precious metal pricing and equities trickle in elsewhere into the broader metals complex. That's certainly what happened after the 2020 move. You know, 2021 and at least the first half of 2022 was the, you know, a year and a half of outperformance amongst the battery metal names and also just the broader industrial metals complex. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that play out at all. And that, of course, would suit the MJG portfolio just fine. We have plenty of precious metal exposure at around 35% of the portfolio, but the rest of that portfolio is split between copper, ag minerals, and then some other battery metals.
Yeah, well, in all fairness, Matt, this is one of the longer bull markets that we've even seen in GDX outside of that 2019 through 2020 run. But there was that big drop of COVID in the middle of that, too. This has been one of the more sustainable uptrends for the stocks. We'll see if that glass half full narrative does play out and this continues. When you're looking at juniors, then let's say people are sitting on the sidelines or looking to rotate some money. What sort of juniors do you see as the best opportunity to take advantage of that potential of that junior catch-up trade?
Well, you can probably imagine what my answer is going to be, and I'll stick to basics. I don't think you have to get too cute here as an investor. Focus on the people first and foremost. Is it a team that you trust and has made money for either you or close members of your network previously? Are they well incentivized, qualified for the task at hand, and focused exclusively at the task at hand? I think you have to ask all of those questions before you even consider getting the next phase of your analysis. Then look at the project that they're working on. I mean, my modus operandi has always been to focus on projects, at least those that are in the development stage, that I think have a chance of being either brought into production or bought out by a bigger player at spot metal prices. I like projects that don't need $4,000 gold or, you know, $6 copper in order to make sense on paper. I want projects that where the numbers look good, you know, at $450 copper or you know, $2,500, $2,300 gold. And if metal prices continue to run in our favor, then great. That's icing on the cake. I mean, another very key point I'd emphasize, especially for some of the earlier stage juniors, is be really careful and make sure that they have sufficient working capital to achieve at least one significant catalyst if not multiple catalysts before considering buying on the open market. And, you know, if you have the ability to participate in private placements and you identify a name that checks all the boxes but needs to raise in the next 3 or 6 months and doesn't have a big drill program that they complete in the meantime, doesn't have a big economic study or a maiden resource coming out where you could see a significant share price rating, be patient. Put a little bit of money aside, sit on your hands, and then evaluate the placement when it's announced. And, you know, for listeners that don't have the ability to participate in private placements, maybe it's best for them to look for juniors that have sufficient working capital to go 12 or 24 months, or stick to some of the bigger names where there's no need to raise capital. And I think it's just sticking with the royalty names can be a smart strategy for those that don't have the ability to kind of participate and evaluate private placements properly. So I would focus on all those points.
Well, Matt, another area we'd like to discuss in the junior mining stocks is, do you think it's significant in a Trump administration where he's mentioned rolling back regulation in his prior term and this term as well, and cutting out the red tape? Could this help on the permitting front? Should U.S.-based companies or companies operating in the U.S. get a premium now because of the potentially better conditions for permitting?
Maybe. I mean, there are certainly pros and some cons, actually, for the metals sector or U.S.-based mining companies due to a Trump administration. Certainly a net positive. But I'd say on the positive front, looking at hot button projects like the, you know, Arctic and Bornite deposits up in the Ambler mining district in north central Alaska. That's a JV split between Trilogy Metals and the much, much larger South 32. I mean, just look at the Trilogy share price. It's a day and a half since the election results became known, and Trilogy's up over 80% as of when I last checked. Another hot button, you know, project that could benefit is BHP and Rio's Resolution project in Arizona. Though, to be fair, they've been trying to push that forward for, you know, 25 years at this point, and we didn't see a significant amount of progress made in Trump's initial 4 years. But for the hot button and more controversial later stage development projects, Trump's win is absolutely a plus. You know, I do anticipate quicker turnarounds on the permitting front as well. I would argue things didn't grind to a stop during the Biden administration, and it's really the first time that we've seen a Democratic administration, I would argue almost any administration, put such an emphasis on critical minerals. So there was still progress over the past 4 years. But I have heard anecdotally from the CEOs of a couple MJG holdings that the response times, for example, on drill permits, you know, whether those are plans of operation or categorical exclusions from, you know, government agencies such as the BLM or the USFS, the Forest Service, they've noticeably slowed over the past few years in terms of response time. So I do anticipate we'll see an improvement there, though we might be looking 12 months down the line before that starts to kick in. And also, you know, just from a plain sentiment perspective, which I don't want to overlook the potential significance of, Trump is viewed as pro-resource extraction, whether that's oil or gas or mining. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And I think particularly for non-US-based mining investors that have been considering U.S.-based mining investments, but have been turned off, I would argue a little bit unfairly, by the Biden administration, their policies, may view this as an opportunity to rush into the space. So I don't want to overlook just the pure sentiment aspect of this. But I'd say quickly, there are a couple cons as well. The first is that there were a spate of articles over the summer talking about loans from the Department of Energy's Loan Program Office, which has provided over $25 billion worth of loans to a couple dozen critical mineral projects. To be fair, most of these have been mineral processing, so not directly related to mining projects, though we have seen big loans announced for Lithium America's Thacker Pass and Ioneer's Rhyolite Ridge, you know, both lithium projects in Nevada. And, you know, Project 2025 calls for the complete abolishment of the Loans Program Office. I think it's likely Trump will follow through on that, though we won't have a good sense for at least another 90 days, maybe 6 months, on whether that's the case. So some of this loan support that we've seen from the federal government could disappear pretty quickly for critical mineral projects. And then I'd also say one point that I haven't heard spoken about too much yet, but I think it's worth flagging, is the potential effects if Trump does institute quote unquote across the board tariffs. And he's been a little bit haphazard. I've heard him say 10 or 20%. But if he does implement across the board tariffs, the effect on capital costs of development stage projects, particularly later stage development projects that actually have a chance of being built within the next 4 years. And if he does follow through on these across the board tariffs, we could legitimately see the, you know, estimates and recent feasibility or pre-feasibility studies jump 10 or 20%. So I think that's worth keeping an eye on. I would note from an MJG perspective, we're pretty insulated from this because at least in terms of our U.S. exposure, it's from earlier stage explorers and prospect generators. So fortunately, that's not a huge concern for the MJG portfolio itself, but it's something that I would keep in mind if you're looking at later stage development projects with projects based in the U.S.
Very interesting comments there, Matt. And it's a question that I've had for some of our other guests is, what will the changes in cost of capital be for these companies? We don't know, but you outline a good point there if these tariffs are put in place on the more aggressive side. Let's circle back around to that investor sentiment standpoint, because look, Trump is viewed as being pro-business. So he should be good for a number of sectors and a number of different businesses. Does that distract investors from coming into the resource sector then?
I think it's a fair point. I mean, his election has been characterized by money flooding into cryptos in particular, with the view that he is going to be a pro-crypto, anti-regulation president on that front. And also just into the broader U.S. indices. Again, I don't want to draw any broad conclusions less than two trading days out from the election taking place. But we have seen the U.S. dollar, you know, take a pretty substantial move higher on the back of this money flowing into the United States, you know, financial assets. But it does, and we'll see how it plays out. I don't want to make any firm prognostications on this front, but it does feel like some of the last gaps of what's already been a very strong move in U.S. equities in particular, really since the Fed rate hike tantrum in mid-2022. So I don't want to read too much into the, you know, immediate aftermath of financial market behavior from his election. But your point is fair. There are other places for money to flow into. And, you know, potentially for a few months here, we'll see money flow into what's been, you know, particularly working in the past 12 or 24 months. And that would be cryptos, high-priced tech stocks, and kind of the U.S. markets more generally relative to the rest of the world. But I feel very confident if you're looking out 3, 4, 5 years, you are going to see the pendulum swing from the U.S. markets to the rest of the world, particularly emerging markets. I think you see the pendulum swing from passive investing strategies towards active investing strategies. I think you see the pendulum swing from growth and speculation towards value. So that my belief hasn't changed on that front, but it's very hard to say what's going to happen in the immediate term.
Yeah, it's always hard to know what's going to happen in the short-term blips, but appreciate you outlining some of the medium to longer-term trends that you think are going to play out in the markets. Let's just pivot back into the junior mining stocks one more time here, Matt, and talk about the M&A cycle. We were talking about this a little bit off mic before the call. You know, I mentioned that I had written an article in June that we'd already had 14 M&A deals. And then you had mentioned that, you know, the things had escalated a little bit in the middle of this year. And even recently, we've seen a couple of deals just announced in the last couple of weeks, Next Gold and Signal Gold merging, Minera Alamos taking over Saber Gold, Aura Minerals moving in on Bluestone in Guatemala. So we've seen some M&A continue to accelerate. How are you looking at the M&A cycle? Where are we at in this M&A cycle?
I think you could argue we're in the strongest window of M&A here within the mining space in over a decade. It's been a flurry of activity. And like you said, it didn't come out of the blue. It was a very strong first half of the year. But I think it really accelerated starting with the Filo tie-up with BHP and Lundin. That was late July, 4.1 billion Canadian there. Followed shortly thereafter by Goldfields, making its move for Osisko Mining. That was 2.1 billion. That was in mid-August. First Majestic's tie-up with Gatto Silver in early September, just before the Beaver Creek conference in Colorado. You know, during the week of the conference, Anglo Gold making its move for sentiment, 3.4 billion right there. Since we last talked, I believe we talked late September, early October, we've seen Core take over Silvercrest. That's another 2.4 billion there. And then the granddaddy of them all, Rio Tinto making its move for Arcadium. That's $9.2 billion. So just those six deals right there, four of them precious metal focused, one of them copper focused, one of them lithium focused, $22.5 billion in total deal value. That is significant in what's, you know, just over a 90-day period there. And then, of course, as you mentioned, there's been a few smaller deals that maybe haven't grabbed the headlines, but are significant in its own right. You mentioned Aura Minerals agreeing to take Cerro Blanco off of Bluestone's hands. That's just over $100 million in total deal value. Though I should note that Bluestone shareholders are receiving a little less than 60% of that figure up front, with the remaining 40% of stated value in CVRs that only pay if Cerro Blanco achieves commercial production. So for that deal, to me, it feels like capitulation by the Lundin-backed Bluestone team, who I think want to move on to bigger and better things, frankly. And meanwhile, you have Aura, which prides itself in its, you know, ESG, you know, CSR approach. They've had some success recently with some of the projects that they brought into production, taking a bit of a flyer on Cerro Blanco, which on paper could be a tremendously profitable asset, particularly at current precious metal prices, but has been plagued by, you know, opposition from local communities, both in Guatemala as well as in El Salvador, right across the border, with concerns about arsenic or other chemicals being, you know, released into local waterways. So that's a long-term process there. And I wish the Aura Minerals team the best in figuring out that situation. That second deal you mentioned, which is directly, you know, relevant to the MJG partnership, is Minera Alamos' takeover of Sabre Gold, and its past producing Copperstone mine in southwestern Arizona. That was only a $30 million deal. I do think it makes sense for both parties. From Sabre's perspective, the company's really been saddled with an ugly balance sheet for a number of years now. Their debt outstanding was close to its stated market cap at the time that the deal was announced. And at least as it stands, you know, Sabre shareholders from the day before the deal was announced are, you know, receiving close to a 75% premium on their shares, where the creditors are receiving, you know, their money back in the process. So it makes sense for Sabre. And then from Minera Alamos' perspective, it was an opportunistic move in what was a pretty distressed company. And Minera Alamos is increasing its gold inventory by over a third, whereas they're only diluting shareholders, their share count by 14-15% as it stands. They're diversifying their risk outside of Mexico, but to a jurisdiction that's not around the world from Mexico, you know, relatively easy access between their operations now in Arizona and their existing operations in Mexico. And also hedging against permitting risk at their Cerro de Oro asset, which was, before this deal, number two in line to come into production after Santana. I think Copperstone will likely skip the line and become the second producing asset for Minera Alamos. Though as it stands, management is saying that they plan to develop those assets jointly. So we'll see if they're able to do that. But directly relevant to the MJG partnership, because we own Star Royalties. And that's a company that I've written about probably in the past five or six MJG investor letters. It's a large position of ours, and they own a 4% life of mine stream covering the Copperstone asset. So that was a really significant development for Star, which saw its share price re-rate on the back of the deal, because we have a credible team coming in with access to capital and mine building experience, stating that they're going to take Copperstone into production as soon as late 2025. I'd love for that to be right. I think that sounds a little optimistic. Maybe, you know, early to spring 2026 is more realistic, but there's now a clear path to production for Copperstone and, you know, cash flow coming in the near future from Star's 4% life of mine stream. So that was an exciting deal. And then I think you mentioned NexGold and Signal merging as well. That was in early October, I believe, so not as fresh off the press as either the Aura Bluestone or the Sabre Minera Alamos deal. But what we see there in short is a Frank Giustra-backed roll-up vehicle coming together here. You know, they're coupling two late-stage development projects, NexGold with its Goliath project in Northern Ontario, Signal with its Goldboro project in Nova Scotia. You know, no immediately clear operational synergies there from what I can tell, but the deal is being marketed as making sense because both projects are expecting to see a completion of permitting in 2025. And NexGold, of course, also has its Niblack project in Alaska, which is not nearly as advanced. That came from a merger with Rob McLeod's Black Wolf Copper and Gold earlier this year, when NexGold was named Treasury Metals and then rebranded as NexGold there. So it looks like a roll-up vehicle in motion. And it'll be interesting to see if that's it for NexGold or another one or two you know, single asset juniors find its way into that vehicle in the foreseeable future.
Matt, have we seen this environment before where we're seeing a lot of these juniors, some of which aren't even in production, start to take on these other assets, still with that overhang of you need to get it built? Other ones are producing, but do they have the cash flow to build other mines within their pipeline if they are bigger projects? What do you take away from this environment, and what kind of deals do you like being seen done when it comes to that blend of development versus already in production assets?
Yeah, well, all else equal, I like to see less juniors on the board. We are overwhelmed with juniors. There's probably 3,000, at the very least 2,500 public listed juniors across the TSXV, the ASX, and then other assorted stock exchanges around the world. So from my perspective, the less the better. There's less homes for capital. There's more likelihood that capital flows into the vehicles that you own. None of these deals are perfect. You know, Aura, to my understanding, doesn't have any Guatemala exposure, so that will be a new jurisdiction for them. In the case of Minera Alamos, you know, they're known as open pit heap leach experts, and Copperstone is an underground mine, though Doug Ramshaw was, you know, very quick to point out that they have significant underground experience within that team as well. And in the case of Next Gold and Signal Gold, there's not immediate synergies between those two assets, you know, from a jurisdiction perspective, but their argument would be they're of similar stages and could be coming online with similar timing. So I wouldn't say any of these deals are, you know, picture perfect, but I take the broader sense that more assets under one roof is better. You know, each of these companies' cost of capital will likely decrease as a result of getting bigger. And I think from a broader, it's good for the space to see less names on the board.
Well, Matt, another piece of news that dropped just recently that I think you have some thoughts on is Ridgeline Minerals, traded on the TSXV under the ticker RDG. They just put out some news, and we heard from the CEO. We'll be bringing them on the show soon as well. Nevada Gold Mines, their partner in Nevada, has drilled a Carlin-type gold hit at their Swift project, hit some higher grade. The company feels this is very significant, and you felt the same way. So maybe weigh in on this particular drill result and why you think it's important for Ridgeline Minerals.
Yes, I do think it's significant. But I should note I'm biased here. We have been Ridgeline Minerals shareholders since the September 2022 private placement. And it's also the most recent featured investment that I included in the July 2024 MJG partnership letter. So full 12-page right up on Ridgeline. But this is a team executing a business model that I have tremendous confidence in. But to turn to the news, there's a little context. This Swift project is located just 7 kilometers and on trend from Nevada Gold Mines' world-class Cortez complex. And, you know, last I checked, Cortez hosted, you know, 25 million ounces of gold with an average grade of roughly 5 grams per ton gold. So this is truly a world-class operation, and Swift is just a short drive away. Nevada Gold Mines, in turn, is earning into Swift. It's still 100% owned by Ridgeline, but NGM is earning into Swift with an agreement to spend US $30 million for up to a 70% stake in the project. In terms of this morning's news release, it provided assays from the first hole of the 2024 drill program. And this was highlighted by an intercept of 1.1 meters at 10.4 grams per ton gold, starting at 676 meters downhole. This is the sixth hole drilled by NGM at the project since they came into the fold a couple years ago. And while the intercept is narrow, there's no question about that, this is highly significant. Ridgeline and NGM already knew that there was a significant gold system at Swift, with the right host rocks as well, the Roberts Mountain Formation. But in historic drilling and recent drilling from NGM, we've seen 51 meters at, you know, 0.19 grams per ton gold, 37 meters at 0.3 grams per ton gold, 49 meters at 0.45 grams per ton gold. So these are certainly significant widths and highly anomalous grades from the drilling that we've seen to date. However, not nearly the grade that is necessary to be economic at 600 or 700 meter depth. That's clear. So the question up until this announcement this morning, we know there's gold here. We know there's the right host rocks, but do we have grades? Does this project exhibit grades that could be remotely feasible at these depths? And I think the answer after this morning is a resounding yes. We've seen grades that are two orders of magnitude higher than anything that was intercepted previously at the project, and grades that, if there is enough tonnage of this material, would be economic at these depths. Whereas if you're talking 0.5 grams per ton material, there's no length of intercept that would make that work at 600 or 700 meters depth. 10 grams per ton gold, there certainly is. So it's now a question of putting the pieces together. Barrick has to spend another US $11.5 million between now and the end of 2026. So in roughly the next 24 months, or this project goes back to Ridgeline on a 100% basis. So I have heard that Barrick will be highlighting this intercept in their Q3 MD&A, which is coming out this afternoon. So it should already be publicly announced by the time that this interview is posted. And I should note that's significant. They've already drilled 5 holes at Swift, and they haven't discussed any of them in their previous disclosure. So this is the first hole that they'll be flagging to their shareholders within their Q3 MD&A. And it says to me that they're very excited with what they're seeing. And it's a foregone conclusion, in my opinion, that they will ultimately get their 60% stake. So that means spending, on average, US $6 million over the next 2 years to complete this first stage of the earn-in. So I would argue this is excellent news for Ridgeline shareholders. We've seen a little bit of a share price reaction. Yes, it's not a 100 gram meter hit that's, you know, splashing across people's news wires as we speak. But I think if you understand the context of the story and get a sense of Barrick's excitement, it gives you a good sense of where this is heading. And I should note, it really opens the door for the potential for 4 different Ridgeline projects to be drilled next year. I think it's a foregone conclusion that we'll see a significant program at Swift. Also has an agreement at Ridgeline's Black Ridge project, where there's a earn-in milestone late next year. So there'll likely be a program there. I think we'll likely see the first drilling at Salina, funded by South 32. That agreement was announced earlier this year. And then Chad Peters, Ridgeline CEO, has been very clear that the company plans to drill their 100% owned Big Blue project on a 100% basis as well. So I think great news from a Swift perspective, and further confidence that next year is going to be a huge year from a news flow perspective for Ridgeline shareholders.
Thanks for breaking that down, Matt. And one other point, I guess, to make is this still does seem fairly early on in that drill program, where Ridgeline needs Nevada Gold Mines to drill this asset, because these are very deep holes. They cost a lot to drill. And look, even if they do earn into that 60% interest, how do you go about attributing different value to Ridgeline Minerals then? The company sits at a $17 million market cap. Yes, they're not going to be spending any money on that asset, at least right now, while Nevada Gold Mines earns into their position. But with all the other drilling that they would like to do, how do you go about giving a value proposition around this company with so much potentially going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's not easy to do. You know, from a back of the envelope perspective, kind of the brain dead way to go about it, saying, oh, well, NGM is spending $30 million to earn a 70% stake, and therefore, you know, the remaining 30% stake is, you know, worth 12 or 13 million US and calling it a day at that. Of course, that doesn't factor in the chance that NGM does not go through with the deal. And it also doesn't factor in the time value of money, because NGM has, you know, a couple years before they need to hit that first milestone payment, and then a couple years beyond that to hit that second milestone spend commitment. The way I look at it for a company like Ridgeline, which I would argue is a hybrid prospect generator, and this is hard to do for your average investor that's not following these companies as closely. But within MJG, we have a proprietary prospect generation business model where I'm tracking 40 prospect generators, primarily in North America, but also a few in Australia. And each year we canvass them and adjust these numbers as the years go on for what their expected partner spend is over the coming 12 months. So that's actually, I think, the best way to look at it, because sure, you can have a huge deal. Rio Tinto comes in and, you know, agrees to spend $75 million for a 75%, you know, stake in said project. But if they have 10 years to do that, you might not see spend until year 6, 7, 8, or 9, if you see that spend at all. And so it really doesn't factor in that time value of money. And I think money going into the ground, you know, in the next 12 months is far better than money potentially going into the ground 4 years out. So for each of these companies, I look at how much they're expecting their partners to put into the ground over the next 12 months. I deem that synthetic revenue is what I would call that. And then I look at the company's enterprise value relative to synthetic revenue. And if you look at all 40 prospect generators as it stands, your average prospect generator is getting about $3 per enterprise value, or $3 in value per $1 of partner spend. Now that can fluctuate. And I think if this bull market continues, we'll see, you know, that increase maybe to increase further. But as it stands, if you have a company that's expecting a prospect generator that's expecting to see $10 million put in the ground by its partners, hypothetically, on average, their enterprise value is roughly $30 million. And so I look at these from a relative perspective, in terms of looking at valuation. So I needed to check the box of the people, the assets, the quality of the partners, the company's financial structure. And then if I'm looking at whether the valuation's fair or undervalued, I'll compare how much they're expecting to go into the ground relative to their enterprise value and how that looks against peers. So that takes a lot of research, but I think that's the best way to kind of ascertain whether these prospect generators are undervalued, fairly valued, or overvalued.
Very interesting. All right, there you have it. Wrapping up the weekend edition of the KE Report with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. I hope you all enjoyed this weekend show. Please go back through our website, kereport.com, and podcast. Search the KE Report in your podcast player to listen to all our daily editorials, many of which where we covered the market moves on the back of the election and a lot of company updates again this week. As always, you can keep in touch with Shad and I through email, and we hope to all see you down at that New Orleans Investment Conference happening November 20th through 23rd. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. Matt, thank you very much for your time.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.